tonight, I'm going to be speaking on actual sin. Now, as I mentioned, I've been under the weather the last several days, so yesterday I was in the kitchen making myself some hot tea, and Father DiMartino wandered in, and I said to him, "Do I have class tomorrow night?" He says, "Yes." I said, "Great." He says, what am I speaking on?" He says, "Something you're truly expert in." Actual sin. Okay, he says, "Just speak from the heart." Okay, so that's what I'm doing tonight. All right, now, about actual sin. Now, before I talk about actual sin, you guys already had your track last time on original sin. All right? Now, if you're Catholic, raise your hand. Okay, good. Now, I want to know, who can tell me, just generally speaking, the difference between an actual sin and original sin? What's the difference? Yes, Miss Aguiar.
Original sin is the one that was passed on from our original.
Right, original sin is passed on from Adam and Eve forward. An actual sin?
Sins that we commit.
Sins that we ourselves commit. Okay, so while we didn't commit original sin, we suffer its effects. And until we're baptized, right, we're guilty of its consequences, right? But actual sins are sins that we actually choose. Now, what age do we normally start hearing confessions of children? At what age about? The age, Helen Ann, do you know the age? About 7. That's called the age of reason. All right? So at the age of reason, we say 7 years old, and I think that's very generous, by the way. Okay, that we start hearing children's confessions. We don't hear confessions before the age of 7. Now, we should make a distinction here. I know from experience that children under the age of 7 are quite capable of being very naughty. And some of them, I've observed, can do some pretty bad things before the age of 7, right? But until they hit the age of 7, we don't call them sinners. We just call them naughty. Or bad, okay? Or terrible, if they're 2. Into 3 seems like these days, right? Okay? Ferocious 4. Forgettable 5. Okay? Whatever. All right? So, but we don't say that they actually are culpable, or that means guilty for sin, until the age of 7. So, for example, if a child were dying in the ER, because of an accident, and I was called in. Do I give that child, they're 6 years old, do I give that child last rites? No, because baptism has covered all that they need. Until they hit the age of 7, they don't need last rites, they don't need to have their confession heard, they don't need the anointing of the sick. Before the age of 7, if they die before the age of 7, they're baptized or assumed automatically to go to heaven. Okay? And, you know, a lot of times this becomes a very contentious point for the parents because they're kind of projecting their own desire for last rites on their child. And I'm telling them they don't need it. It won't have any effect on them because they're not in need of the sacrament. So if they are to die before the age of 7 and they're already baptized, they're covered. And they will go straight to heaven. Which, of course, on the flip side of things, if that does happen to parents and children, is a tremendous consolation to the parents that, you know, their child went to heaven. Okay, I mean, obviously, the loss of a child is a very devastating blow, and understandably so, but there is some consolation knowing that at least that child has gained eternal glory. All right? So, okay, so we're square between the difference between original sin and actual sin. Okay, now, let's get a little bit more into actual sin. Now, Father DiMartino really told me today, he said, you know, there's a book out there called The Sinner's Guide. But it's not a how-to book. Okay? As many people think it is. Okay? It's a book actually devoted to helping us understand how we sin, why we sin, how it comes about, and what we can do to stop and then to amend our lives. Okay, now, there are two kinds of actual sin. Who wants to tell me what the two kinds of actual sin are? Diane, you want to tell me the two kinds of actual sin?
Venial.
Uh-huh. And mortal. Okay, venial and mortal. Good. Okay. Now, mortal sin is also kind of also known as deadly sin. All right, it's, you know, that's where it really comes from, mors, which means death. Now, why do we make this distinction? It's interesting because, you know, the way that Catholicism is portrayed in the media and in popular culture is what? We're very consumed with sin, like, and guilt, right? And that if you just weren't Catholic, you wouldn't feel guilty. Okay? And so people who leave the church say, I left the church because I wanted to stop feeling guilty. Okay. So, interesting. But this whole notion of distinguishing between mortal and venial sins is as old as the church herself's founding. So, this is a scripture quote you can always use. People say, well, why do you guys even make distinctions? I mean, isn't lying, lying, period? I mean, isn't lying to your wife about how she looks the same as lying in a courtroom? I hope not. I mean, don't you? Guys? Right? Right? Okay? Is perjury the same as telling your wife she looks great when she doesn't? Okay, I hope not. Okay? So this is what, this is the first letter of St. John. So this is 1 John 5. So the first letter of John, chapter 5, verse 17. This is what St. John writes. All wrongdoing is sin, but there is sin which is not mortal. Ah, there is sin that is not mortal. It says all wrongdoing is sin, agreed? But not all sin is mortal, means deadly. Okay, so right there in 1 John 5, verse 17, we already have scriptural evidence and an idea that the church really understood this idea that, you know, there's more to just sin than just sin. There are different kinds of sins. Now, what's the difference between a venial and a mortal sin? A venial sin always involves less serious matter. I'll make a distinction. Lying or stealing on your taxes is different than pilfering through the stationery closet at the office. Right? There better be. And, you know, as you're thinking about these things, you better be glad they are. Could you imagine if pilfering through the stationery closet carried the same penalty in the code of law as cheating on your taxes? We'd all be in jail. All right? The difference is just who got caught and who didn't. All right. So, remember, venial sin always involves less serious matter. Okay, so, let's talk about mortal sin. That always involves three things to have a mortal sin. And you need to have all three. Not just one, but all three. In order to have a mortal sin, you have to be involved with something regarding grave matter. Okay? So, something serious. Like cheating on your taxes, that's grave matter. Okay? Two, you need to have sufficient reflection. That means you have at least enough time to think about what you're doing. You don't have to take a whole day, okay? And you don't have to take a graduate course, all right? Just so long as you have enough time to reflect on it. So, in other words, usually meaning premeditated. All right? And then the third thing would be intent of the will. So I'll say those three things again. To have a mortal sin, you need to have grave matter, sufficient reflection, and intent of the will. Now, if you're missing one of these three things, you have not committed a mortal sin. You're missing one, you don't have a mortal sin. Get me? All right? You have to have all three to have a mortal sin. So, let me say this again in a different kind of language, right? It's grave matter, sufficient reflection, intent of the will. So it's wrong, you knew it, and you did it anyway. Right? That simple. It's wrong, you knew it, and you did it anyway. So, I'll give you an example how things that are grave matter aren't always mortal sins. The part that is dealing with grade matter is always objective. But whether or not you had enough time to think about it or you intended it with the will is somewhat subjective. So I'll give you an example. Let's say a girl goes and has an abortion. Now a lot of people will say that's always a mortal sin. No, it's not. It's always grave matter. Always grave matter. It's serious. That's serious. Okay? Now let's think of the circumstances here. Let's say she's 13 and she has been forced into this abortion by her father, who's basically threatened even her life if she doesn't do it. Okay? All right. Was it her will to abort the baby? Well, no. It's her father's will, but not hers. In fact, she'd like to keep the baby. All right? Or to keep the baby and place the baby in for adoption. All right. And let's just say, in the whirlwind of telling her father, he didn't give her much time at all and just struck her in the car and took her down to Planned Parenthood and, quote unquote, took care of business. Did she have time to think about her decision? Was it even her decision? See what I'm talking about? So yes, is abortion always grave? Yeah, she fits qualification number one. But does she fit qualifications two and three, sufficient reflection and intent of the will? Probably not. Again, to have a mortal sin, you need to have all three. I'll give you another example. Let's say that this is an easy example, but worth bringing up. Let's say you're at home asleep, and someone breaks in, and you reach under your bed and take out your shotgun. Clack, clack. Right? You say to the guy, don't come through that door, you're going to be sorry. And he busts the door open, and it's no one you recognize, and he's wearing a ski mask. Okay? And you shoot him, and he dies. Is that grave matter? Yes. Killing someone is always grave matter. In this particular instance, though, we would call it self-defense. And there are two things that really, you know, probably were not present. Did you have enough time to think about what to do? Well, not really. Didn't quite have a chance for an interview. Didn't have a chance to do a background check. Kind of reasonably suspected that they were probably going to try to kill you. Right? And you even give them sufficient warning. Don't come through that door, you're going to be sorry. Okay? And was your will to kill him? Probably not, just to protect yourself. See what I'm talking about? But is killing someone always grave? Yeah. Killing someone's always grave. It is. Even in wartime, it's grave. But you might have other reasons in there that might make a mortal sin not possible. Any questions about that? So remember, it's wrong, you knew it, and you chose to do it anyway. That's the easiest way to think about a mortal sin. Now, I want to exploit two extremes in this regard. There are some people who think that as long as I don't rape or kill anyone, I haven't committed a mortal sin. Not true. I'll give you an example. Very common. Missing mass. Missing mass is grave matter. It's a violation of the third commandment. Keep holy the Sabbath. That's grave matter. Now, let's say you're on your way to Mass. I mean, you're intending to go to Mass. But you see your neighbor on the side of the road, and they're in distress. And it's 4:55 in the afternoon, last Mass around here at 5, right? And you go and help your neighbor. Okay. So, was your intent to miss Mass? No. Actually, you were on your way to Mass. In fact, it pained you that you got your nice Sunday clothes all marred up with whatever, you know, thing you had to deal with, all right, on the side of the road. Okay. But that's different than someone who wakes up on Sunday and says, not interested. Hours pass, not interested. Mass after mass after mass. Okay? You see the difference? So remember, how about this? This happens all the time. We're going on vacation, Father, and there's no Mass. That's not a mortal sin, is it? Yes, it is. I'm sorry. Fix your vacation plans. Oh, well, we missed Mass because our travel plans got messed up. Right. So you traveled on Sunday. Could you have made Mass on Saturday night? Yeah. Oh, okay. So you kind of just left it up to chance, right? I mean, you didn't really make it a point to get to Mass. You just kind of left it like, well, when we get there, we get there. That's not intent to go to Mass. That's intent to leave it up to chance. And the airlines, which you know are not are very unpredictable and unreliable. Okay? So you see the difference? People say, well, we're going on a cruise. Well, find a Mass. Well, we're going to be at sea. Find another itinerary. God asks for 168 hours of the week and you can't give him one? I mean, seriously? A 10% tip would be 16.8 hours. And you can't give him one. So ask yourself next time, do I really lack the generosity necessary to make 1 hour out of 168? But it's a cruise of a lifetime. Right, and then the next day it hits an iceberg and you go down in mortal sin. Great. What a cruise of a lifetime. It's a cruise into eternity too. Okay, so see, people are very willing to write themselves off and take a pass. What usually constitutes grave matter? Violation of divine precept. Start with the Ten Commandments. And then start working your way down from that. Now, as we go along in this part of the course, does anyone have the syllabus where we're going with all of this? I think we're entering the moral section, I'm guessing, because I'm talking about sin. Does anyone have a syllabus, like the schedule classes? You got that there, Sherry? Let me take a look at that for one sec. Yeah, so now we're talking about, yep, there we go. Oh my goodness, it's all me all the way down. Okay. Sin, sinner, I'm an expert sinner. Okay, so December 2 through January 13, we're just talking about the commandments. Okay, so what we're going to do in the next several weeks is I'm going to open up the Ten Commandments and show you, okay, it says, thou shalt not kill, but what else does that mean? All right, does that just mean strictly homicide, and as long as you're outside of homicide, you're in the clear? I wish, but not that simple. Okay, so we're going to kind of go through all the different steps and figure out what we're missing along the way. Okay, any questions about that so far? No? Okay. Now, let's talk about this part here. Now, this is always objective, grave matter, okay? But your reflection and your intent of the will can be subjective. Depends on the individual, all right? Did they have enough time to think about it? Did they think about it? All right, so there are things that can affect whether or not you will to do something. To will something is to mean to exercise a faculty called voluntariness. Whether or not you voluntarily did something. Okay? Now I'm going to go through the whole... I'm going to talk about things that affect whether or not you actually made an act of the will in doing something. Okay? So these are four things that could affect whether or not your will was engaged when you committed a sin. Okay, the first thing would be fear. Okay, so to make sure I get this all lined up correctly. Okay, then the first thing is fear. Another could be force. Another could be passion. Or another thing could be ignorance. So these are four factors which can affect whether or not you exercised your will in committing a sin. In fact, if any of these four things are strong enough, it may reduce, if not altogether remove, your individual subjective guilt for the sin. So confessors, you know, priests, we're sitting in the confessional and people are confessing their sins. Now, once in a while, we may ask you questions because we're trying to help determine whether or not we're really talking about a mortal sin or not. I'll give you an example. In the going to Mass question, I missed Mass. Okay, well, why? I was sick. Well, that's not a sin. It's not? No, it's grave matter, but... Were you intending to miss Mass? No, I wish I could have gone. I don't like to miss, and I really don't. But I was sick, and I didn't want to go for two reasons. One, I couldn't get out of bed, and two, I didn't want to get anyone else around me sick. Okay, fine. So is your intent to miss Mass? No, my intent is to actually preserve my health. and also not to spread disease. Okay. See? But they say, oh, well, good, Father, I'm glad, because I've been carrying that all week. I said, well, see, you have to have good moral analysis to be able to know whether or not you're... I mean, you might have done something grave, like missed Mass, but that's objective. But is your subjective sinfulness actually present? Did you think about it? Yeah, I thought about it. Was your intent to miss Mass? No. My intent was actually to make Mass, and actually I tried to do it, but I was trying to get ready, but I was just feeling nauseous, and I just knew this is not going to be pretty. And so I decided, okay, you know, I know the Church doesn't require the unreasonable or the impossible, so I used my judgment and said, probably not a good idea. Okay, fair enough. But you see why I have to ask questions? Because then if I don't ask questions and I just miss Mass, then I miss an opportunity to teach someone in that moment. You don't need to confess that. Well, I felt bad about it. Hey, feeling bad does not mean you committed a sin. Let me give an example of that, okay? Feeling bad about something does not mean you committed a sin. Let's say Father DiMartino is a bank robber. Okay? And he loves it. You know, day off, Sunday nights, no one's around, okay? He loves robbing banks. And he loves the fact that he's always kind of one step ahead of the law. No one in the community suspects it. And he's got to pay off a debt, right? You know, so he's got lots of good reasons to do this, right? Okay. But he robs banks all over the area. He's an excellent robber. It's nonviolent entry. It's all clandestine, you know, and, you know, no one gets hurt. There are no security guards present. It's just, you know, very clean, okay? Okay. But the thing is that Father DiMartino is committing pretty serious sin, but he feels great about it. In fact, he feels like a Robin Hood, sort of noble, in some twisted way, okay? Now, you see what I'm saying? Don't equate feeling bad with committing sin and vice versa. Because some sinners love to commit their sins, and they don't feel bad about them at all. They don't feel, it's fine, okay? So, you know, when you're making your judgments of conscience, don't let it be merely based on, oh, I felt bad. I mean, confession is not therapy. Okay, as you notice, if you've noticed, you've been in our confessionals, there's no green leather couch. Okay, and we don't charge you by the hour. Okay, so it's a place to go to have your sins absolved. That's where it's a place to go, not to go to therapy. Okay, now, so here are the four things that can affect your will, your willpower, or your engagement of the will in sin. Okay, first is fear. All right, let's take the girl in the abortion example I used earlier. Right? She's basically been threatened by her father that if she doesn't go and get the abortion, he's going to throw her out on the street. Now, for a 13-year-old, that's genuine fear. It's not like she's 18, can get her own job and kind of, you know, make it on her own. She doesn't really have anywhere to go. That's real fear. Okay, so that might have affected her voluntariness, the use of her will. How about force? Let's say Father DiMartino is really into a big heist this week, and he takes me at gunpoint to drive the car, the getaway car, and he's holding a gun to my head. He says, my God, stay here. If I come back, oh, I know where you live. Okay? So he's got a gun in the back of my head, and he said, you better stay right here, pal, or else. Okay? So that could be force. I mean, you have situations like that. All right? Next is passion, concupiscence. Okay? So, like, you know, in the heat of the moment, self-defense often falls into that category. In the moment, you know, I mean, you just, okay, I wasn't thinking about it. It was just like, okay, just what we did. Or that's a decision I made. Okay, I didn't have time to think about it. It's just, you know, it was the heat of the moment, they call it. All right, that's one example. Or ignorance. Well, I didn't know that was wrong. I mean, true, you could have Catholics who've grown up being told their entire lives that missing Mass on Sunday isn't wrong. I know a lot. I mean, half of the kids who go to religious ed in our school here on Sunday, half don't go to Mass. They go to CCD, they go to religious ed, but they don't go to Mass. Because their parents basically choose one or the other, Mass or CCD. because you get your religion hour in. So you either do your Mass or your CCD. Well, the church expects you to do both Mass and religious ed. But if you're going K through 8, and you're basically told every week, hey, you don't have to go to Mass. It's either you're going to go to Mass or you go to religious ed. If you do one, that's enough. Well, you see how someone's conscience over the years can be warped into thinking that that's fine. So they get to, like, let's say 8th grade, and or 9th grade, 10th grade, are going for confirmation, and they're told by the people doing the formation, you need to get to Mass, and if you haven't been going to Mass, you need to go to confession. I didn't know going to Mass was a sin, or not going to Mass was a sin. I didn't know missing Mass was going, that was a sin. And they honestly didn't. Now, I used to think that that was like a really bogus excuse, like, I didn't know you had to go to Mass on Sunday. My Jewish friends know you have to go to Mass on Sunday, okay? But I'm becoming less and less convinced that some of these kids really know that. Because they don't even know how to make the sign of the cross. I mean, many of them have never prayed a rosary in their life. They wouldn't even know how to pray a rosary. If I said, if you can't pray a rosary in the next 20 minutes, we're going to shoot you. They'd be dead. You know? So, again, these are four factors which could affect the engagement of your will. So remember, you have grave matter, sufficient reflection, and intent of the will. Your will can be affected by these four things: ignorance, passion, force, and fear. Any questions about that? No? Wow, okay, you guys, yes. Question in the back.
Father, you're saying if you don't know you've sinned, then you didn't sin.
If you didn't know you sinned, oh no, better. If you didn't know you committed an act of grave matter. There's a difference, right? Because remember I made a difference between grave matter and sin?
I wasn't talking
if you didn't know it, no, not necessarily. In fact, I'm glad you said that because that is exactly what I'm going to talk about next, about ignorance itself. There are two kinds of ignorance. I'm glad you said that because that's exactly my next topic. But do you have any other questions? That's your question? Any other questions? Because that's what I'm going to talk about next. That's next on my list. No? Okay. Would you come here for a second and help me turn this around? Thanks. You just did, yeah, like Vanna. Right. Thank you. Like Vanno. Okay, thank you, sir. Okay. Now, there are two kinds of ignorance you can have. All right? One is called vincible, or what's called culpable ignorance. The other is called invincible or non-culpable ignorance. Okay? Now, what's vincible, culpable ignorance? Officer, I didn't know it was 25. Tell that to the judge. It's posted and lit. And you're in a residential neighborhood. You should have known it's 25. Where isn't it 25? See what I'm saying? You didn't know? You should have. Now, this gets back to that question I was just talking about, Mass attendance. You didn't know you had to go to Mass on Sunday? You should have. Everyone knows that. Okay. I used to think that. I leave it up to, I mean, I take it on a case-by-case basis. I mean, it used to be that we lived in a culture where there was a general sense of each other's religious duties. Like, you knew that Jews were off on Saturdays, Catholics were off on Sundays, and Muslims are kind of off on Fridays. And you kind of had a sense of that thing, and there were so few Muslims, really, anyway. Like, if you grew up in New York City, you just knew that the Jews were not going to be at work on Saturday. They'd be there on Sunday, but the Catholics wouldn't be, because the Catholics would be closed on Sunday. Okay, you kind of get a sense of that kind of stuff. But these days, gosh, with religious ignorance out there, I'm not necessarily sure I would even put knowing if going to Mass on Sunday is always vincible, culpable. But let's take back to that example of the officer and the speeding. You didn't know it was 25. It's posted, son. Okay, you should have known it's 25. Can you not read? If you can't read, you shouldn't be able to drive, right? Okay. So if there's ignorance where you should have known but didn't, that can be culpable. That's not an excuse. But if you had ignorance where you didn't know and there's no reasonable way you could have known that? Fine, I'll give you an example. One sunny day, in my first assignment as a priest in Vienna, Virginia, that's near Tyson's area, I got a phone call. This woman's very upset. And she wanted to come in and talk to me. I said, you know, I'm sorry, but I can't take you today. If it's an emergency, maybe, but what's going on? Well, I'm just really stressed out and I want you to pray for me. And I said, okay, well, what's going on? And she says, I have a very, very important medical procedure tomorrow that I want you to pray goes well. And I said, okay, well, would you mind me asking what it is? I'm having in vitro fertilization. Okay? So she wanted me to pray for the success of her in vitro procedure. And I said, no! I'm not praying for that success. I'm praying that you don't have it at all. She says, what? Are you a Catholic priest? Yeah! But I thought you guys were pro-life. Yeah, we're pro-life. But I want to have a baby. Isn't that pro-life? Ma'am, did you know that having in vitro fertilization treatments are immoral? No. Really? I just assumed. Never assume anything, right? Isn't that one of the signs of maturity? Never assume anything. Right, okay. Now, this woman honestly thought it was a good idea. And I mean, I read her law. I understood her logic. She's pro-life. She wants to have a kid. I mean, it's all there, right? They've been trying for years, couldn't, and they just finally decided this is what they were going to do. I said, did you ever consult a priest or someone of moral authority to sort out whether or not this was a good... No, I just assumed it was fine. I mean, I've had lots of people in my family do it. This is a chronic problem, this infertility we have among the women. So it just seemed like a very natural thing. We just want to do that, and we didn't want to adopt, and okay. Okay, see? So, now, in that particular case, until that moment, non-culpable ignorance. She didn't know. Was it reasonable for her to have known that? Well, not necessarily. I mean, is in vitro fertilization a moral topic that people discuss on the street all the time? Not really. It generally tends to be something that's discussed behind closed doors, you know, in the privacy of doctor's offices. It's not really, I mean, I've never given a homily on in vitro fertilization. And even if I did, I'd be definitely the one half 1% of priests who have. You see what I'm saying? It's not really like a hot burner issue because, I mean, it only touches a certain fraction of people in the pews. See what I mean? Okay. But, okay, so until that point, she's under invincible ignorance. She didn't know, and there was no reasonable way for her to know. But having talked to me for 5 minutes, now when she has it tomorrow, she's invincible, culpable ignorance. Because now she knows, and I've told her now. And I've corrected her and given her instruction on what she should do. And of course, as a woman of conscience, she's dying because she just put down a $7,000 deposit 2 weeks earlier. And she says, well, I paid $7,000 for this. And I said, don't put a price on your soul. Your soul's worth more than $7,000, believe you me. So then I can't get it back. Yeah, I know. But I said, well, listen, I've instructed your conscience. It's up to you. I can't make you not go. I pray that you don't, but it's really up to you. You're still radically free to do what you want. Well, if I go, will it be a sin? Yes! So you're telling me, Father, if I hadn't called you? Maybe. I don't know. I'd have to sort that out with you and figure out what you knew, what you didn't know. But I'd be willing to give you the benefit of the doubt. Okay? And this happens all the time in the confessional. You know, you have couples who come back to the faith after many years away. They were using contraception in their marriage. They were told that that was fine. No one ever said it was wrong. And they never heard a homily in their life telling them, and their parents have been doing it, and they got all kinds of pressures from the family not to have more kids, etc., etc. And honestly, it wasn't until they heard maybe stronger preaching, did some reading, had some friends to kind of inform them what was really going on, what the story was, and what the church really taught, that they kind of came to the light of faith and said, oh, okay. So they come back to confession after many years, and they confess it. They say, Father, I didn't know that, but, you know, I'm sorry I did it now that I know why I should not have done that. You see what I'm saying? So people come to that. And so, you know, I'm sitting there on the other side of the screen, and I'm trying to sort out, okay, well, you know, okay, you didn't know. I mean, if you came to the faith recently as an adult and, you know, had no access to the faith and, you know, to the truth of the gospel, okay, fine. Okay. And you can believe you me, I mean, it's a tremendous burden off their backs, right? This is what I say every year. It's going to happen again this year. I know some of you guys are in the military. A number of you guys are Marines, okay, or have Marine background, okay? You guys have no problems charging a hill being shot at. But God help you to get in line for confession. Right? I've had Marines tell me, Father, I'm more nervous about going to confession to Father DiMartino than I ever was in Afghanistan and when I was taking fire. I said, why? Because in Afghanistan, I knew what to do with my gun. And I knew what we could do. And I knew our tactics. And I felt pretty comfortable and confident. But Father, when I go to Father DiMartino for confession, oh my gosh. I mean, it's just like, oh, you know, I don't have a knife. I don't have a gun. There's nothing I can do about this. You know, I'm totally exposed. Okay? But then on the other side of that, then they say, Father, it was not nearly as bad as I thought it was going to be. And Father's a prince of a confessor. I mean, his lines are twice as long as mine. That tells you anything, right? Okay. So, you know, they say afterwards, oh, gosh, you know, what a relief. You know, I mean, there's this build-up to it, and people are so nervous about it. But I'll tell you, as someone who goes to confession every week, there's no build-up to it at all. You know, and the more you, for those of you who are Catholic and know this, for those of you who go often, I mean, yes, going to confession, and I didn't say it's not a big deal, but it's less of a big deal if you go frequently. Okay? So, at the end of all of this moral stuff, we'll be talking about the sacrament of penance. Okay, any questions about that? Okay. Now, next thing I want to talk about is, let's see, we've done, how about this question that comes up often? Do the ends justify the means? Very common question. The ends justifies the means. Do the ends justify the means? Okay, now what do I mean by that? Well, sometimes people will rationalize their moral activity because they want a good result, but they'd be willing to do immoral things to get there. Take the Father DiMartino bank robbing example. Father DiMartino's intent is to pay off the debt. That's a good aspiration. Okay? Not a bad thing, because, you know, when you're saddled with debt, as any of you know have ever had personal debt or business debt, it really kind of holds your hands tied to a lot of other things you could be doing to really grow the parish. It just kind of always is this black cloud. Okay, so he wants to settle the debt. So what means does he use to do that? Robbing banks. Okay, now that should be a very obvious example that the ends do not justify the means to get there. If you're doing something immoral to get to a noble goal or end, it doesn't make the nobility of the goal or the end somehow the justification for your immoral means. Does it make sense? Okay. So this happens all the time. You know, for example, when we'll get into these in the individual commandments, I lied so as to protect someone. Right? My buddy at work was going to lose his job, so I lied to protect him. Okay, how about another example? I am building a house by myself, and I work at Home Depot, and I'm in the stock room, and there's lots of supplies that never get moved. I mean, they just sit there month after month after month. And honestly, I don't even know whether these things are ever going to be sold. Half of these things, I think, are defective anyway. So I'm going to take it upon myself to take some home with me and use them to build my house. Now, my goal is noble. I want to get a new house. I want to put, you know, roof over my kids, you know, for my kids and my wife, okay? But, you know, and no one knows, you know, wink, wink. And I see everyone else doing it. You know, they just take things home. All right? So I got this call one time. I got this, I do this talk show, radio talk show once a month. And I got this call, and this is the call that the host and I were tackling. And I said, okay, well, let me ask you a question. Let's say, I think his name was Scott. I hope his name wasn't really Scott because, you know, he was calling from a particular town. And I'm like, boy, I hope you don't get, like, you know, you're incriminating yourself. Hi, I'm Jerome from Stafford, and I work at Home Depot. Long-time listener, first-time caller. You dummy. Okay. So he said, well, Father, I don't understand why what I just described is wrong. Same case I just gave you. I said, okay, let's just say Home Depot decides to close up that store tomorrow and they want to sell their entire inventory to Lowe's. Don't you think that you've unjustly deprived Home Depot of money that they could have made on the sale of that inventory even though it wasn't moving? They sold the entire inventory to Lowe's. You're stealing from your employer. Now, he had come up with this really interesting way of rationalizing how it wasn't stealing. You know, well, they really owe me because, you know, like I do a lot of OT time and I never really record it. Hey, that's not their fault. If you do OT and you don't put it on your time card, that's not their problem. That's your problem. You need to write that down. And they owe you for that. But don't start trying to pay each other, pay yourself back through their, you know, through their inventory and justify it because you forgot to write down your hours on your time card. See how people do this? They do it all the time. Okay, so really having sort of a properly formed conscience and moral rectitude does require you to be a little bit more sensitive and attuned to some of those things. Okay, any questions about that? All right, last thing tonight we're going to talk about is cooperation. When can I or not cooperate in certain kinds of behaviors or activities? Okay? This is a really, really, to me, very, very interesting area of moral study. And I'll give you an example, a very real example. Okay? Down in Colonial Beach, if you know where that is, it's about 40 miles south east of here on the Northern Neck. I was assigned there from 2003 to 2007. This is where I started this free clinic. I have a pharmacist on staff at the clinic there. And she now works for Walmart. But she used to work for Rite Aid or CVS, one of these, you know, other big chains, okay? Now she quit because as a pharmacist, they were forcing her to fill out birth control pill prescriptions. Okay? And morning after pills and all kinds of other things. Right? And she wanted to exercise a conscience clause that said, I'm not telling you you can't do that, but don't ask me to do that. So I'll leave the script for the next pharmacist on duty. If they want to do that, that's their business, but I'm not, okay. Well, they kind of, I mean, she could really have filed a lawsuit here, but she was basically put in a situation, a scheduling situation, where her unwillingness to fill out those scripts really began to impinge on her evaluation at each quarter for her promotion because she lacked cooperative spirit, not a team player. You see what I'm saying? I mean, the employer has all kinds of devious ways of making this difficult for you to exercise a conscience clause. So she quit. Okay? And she and I had to sit down over the course of several cups of coffee to to discuss her cooperation in this sin of dispensing contraceptives. Okay, now, it's interesting, right? Because it's not the case that the use of all contraceptive pills is for contraceptive reasons. Right? Sometimes women are using contraceptive pills because they're just trying to regulate their period. I understand that. Okay? But Mary, my pharmacist, doesn't have the luxury of knowing whether or not in every individual case that she's handing out contraceptives, that that's in fact what they're being used for. And she certainly can't ask the patients, "Hi, yeah, I can fill a script, but are you trying to avoid pregnancy, or is this just, you know?" You can't do that. Okay, like, what's this for? Okay? Right? You can't do that. I mean, she said, "I wish I could, and that way I could, with a clear conscience, fill out some of these scripts, because I knew that this was not being used as a contraceptive. It was really being used as a sort of some medicinal, you know," and for those of you who are in the healthcare field know that the use of a contraceptive pill for that purpose anyway is bad medicine anyway, but that's for our discussion of the Sixth and Ninth Commandment sins. We'll work on that another day, okay? I won't get into that today. All right, so, cooperation. So Mary had to figure out, we had to figure out, whether or not she could be working at the CVS or the Rite Aid. I forget exactly where it is. I don't want to incriminate a certain place because I don't remember which one it was. Okay, there are two kinds of cooperation. There's formal cooperation, and then there's what's called material cooperation. Very important distinction. Okay? Now, under material cooperation, you have proximate and remote. Okay? And formal is just formal. It is what it is. Okay. Now, what's the difference? Formal cooperation is helping in the committing of an immoral act when I share the evil intent. Okay? So, you know, let's say I'm a Nazi guard. And we're exterminating Jews. It's World War II. I'm not just exterminating Jews. I believe that we should do this. Okay? That should be pretty obvious. Formal cooperation. I'm a helper, and I share in the intent of the overall operation of the group. Okay? All right. Now, is that my friend Mary? No. Okay? She's a helper, but she does not share in the intent of contraceptives being used. Okay? It could be incidental. Okay, now, let's talk about material. Okay? Material cooperation, okay, generally means that you're helping, but you don't share the intent. All right? So, that's Mary. She's somewhere in there. Proximate or remote. Now, the difference should be fairly obvious just from the words. Remote means far away. Proximate means your helping is very closely allied with the actual illicit activity going on. Okay? So, proximate material cooperation means that what you're doing to help is very close to the evil being done, right? You don't share the intent, because no material cooperator shares the intent, but your help provides an almost indispensable or non-substitutable help. That's Mary. They can't get the pill at her pharmacy unless she fills the script. See what I'm saying? Okay, so they can get it from another one, and that's why she was saying, "Look, have another pharmacist fill the script. Don't ask me to do it." It was only at Walmart where they respected that. So that's where she went to go work. Okay? So again, in material cooperation, you don't share in the intent, but if you're a proximate helper, your help is indispensable. Now, remote means you also don't share the intent, and you also, your help is also not indispensable. For example, let's say you're a cab driver in D.C. All right? Now, don't ask me why I know that 14th Street is a red light district. I just do. Okay? All right. So, I'm a cab driver in D.C. All right? And it's Thursday night. Very common. A lot of businessmen are out on the street after work. Okay? And he jumps in my cab. And he says, "Hey, amigo, I'm looking for some action." Okay. What do you mean? "Well, you know, I'm looking for a date. Can you take me to a place where I can get a date?" Sure, I guess. So we're driving along, and I pull up two blocks from 14th Street. I'm on 16th. Right? And he says, "This doesn't look like much of a place where I could find a date." And I just say, "Well, it's in this vicinity somewhere. $5, please." Now, I don't share in his intent. Okay? And my help's not in this, my help is substitutable. Because really, I'm just letting him off a nondescript place. He's going to ask somebody else. Their help is going to be the non-substitutable help. But I'm going to just distance myself from the situation, and I say, "It's around here somewhere, I think." So I leave doubt in his mind, and I just charge him the money for the fare that's fair, no pun intended, to take him to that spot. Thank you very much. Good night. See that? So in that particular case, my help was material but remote. Now, as a Catholic, okay, you may never participate in either of these types of acts. You may never be a cooperator that's either proximately material and certainly never formal. Here, you've got some wiggle room. So Mary, my friend, the pharmacist, she works at Walmart. They do dispense contraceptives at Walmart. They do. But she isn't the person doing it. Okay? Is it coming across the counter that she works at? Yes. But is she doing it? No. And she's making an actual objective act of the will not to do that. Okay? She does not share in the intent, and her help is substitutable. In fact, they have someone else who does that for her, so that she doesn't have to do that. So they respect her conscience. Right? Now, I would just tell you, just from my experience in the medical field and in clinic work, there's a group there called Pharmacists for Life, okay, that really bind together to try to protect each other in conscience clauses. But I'll tell you, the way that adjudication goes in the courts these days, it is becoming increasingly more difficult to get away with. All right, the way that judges adjudicate from the bench, it's very hard to practice a lot of these conscience clauses. I mean, there's a direct, open persecution of Christian values in the judicial branch. I mean, there's no question about it. And I don't think that's really just my opinion. I think that's something held commonly across the board. Many of you know that. Okay? But, you know, I'm proud of Mary because, you know, it struck her one day as she was going, and she came back to the church after many years away and said, "You know, Father, I really want to talk to you about this, something really weighing on my conscience, and I'm not really sure I can be doing this. And I'm willing to give up my profession if I can't practice it morally." Okay, that's a real believer right there, right? Okay. But thankfully, we were able to find a way for her to practice her craft, her art of pharmaceutical dispensation without doing it immorally. And it'd be a shame, you know, if you couldn't practice particular kinds of professions without doing so honorably, right? But thankfully, in Mary's case, it worked out. Okay. Any questions about that? Yes. Yes. Benefiting from somebody's sin.
In case in point, today you heard of that they cleared the way for a lot of sex filters. One child happens to have a hole in her heart.
Uh-huh.
It's not going to affect anything to her, but they're talking about being able to regrow heart tissue from the stem filter.
that whole age of reason wouldn't even be a factor in the decision-making. The question was whether or not you can benefit from other people's sinfulness. Let me give you a parallel example. Maybe we can sort it out going backwards, okay? Let's say you stole... Let's say you stole $300 from your company. Now, you didn't go to the petty cash drawer and do it outright like that, okay? Over the course of a month, on your reimbursement charges, you over-reimbursed yourself, okay? You know, the accountant, they don't really check the receipts that much, and when it's below $500, they don't really, you know, care, okay? But you know that over the course of a month that you've made $300 on this. Or let's say it's your mileage reimbursement. You fudged the numbers on how far you drove, so you're making money on it, right? Okay. So, month's end, you know that you've stolen, okay, and you know you're thinking about this one day after work, and you're like, I just went to Magad's class last night, I'm busted, and I can't do this anymore, and it's time to, you know, okay? And I'm looking at the man in the mirror, and, you know, it's time to make a change, okay? All right, so after this Michael Jackson moment, you decide, okay, now, how am I going to give my $300 back to the company? Because I owed them $300. Okay, now, would it just look really suspicious if I wrote the accountant a check for $300? Yeah. Would that get me in trouble? Yeah. Okay. So the point is, I can't benefit, though, from having $300 extra in my pocket. I can't. So what would the good priest say in the confessional? Okay, what you need to do is you need to make a contribution to the poor or to your favorite charity in that amount so that while you won't get caught for your transgression, we don't want you to get caught for that, okay? But I think a good restitution would be is that you make a contribution to needy people in that amount. Right now, can you make that a part of your penance? No. The penance is three Hail Marys. But if you're really serious about making restitution for this, I think it would be appropriate for you to make a donation in that amount to some charity or some good cause or the church or the poor or whatever so that you don't benefit. Okay. So let's take it to the example you're using. Same question arises whether or not you can use fetal tissue derived from abortions to do certain procedures. The answer is no, you can't. Because you are basically creating a market and an avenue for more of that stuff to be done. You're creating a demand for it to be done. However, I would say this. Given that there has never been a proven, durable cure given from embryonic stem cell research, adult stem cell research is the way to go. There have been 15,000 known cures in Europe and the United States, zero for embryonic. So I would go with what works. And I'll tell you also what tells me what works. Maybe this is just my business background. I want to know where venture capital firms are investing money. Because they do a lot of research. Some of my closest friends have worked on Wall Street as VC analysts, and they know where the money is. Okay? Are they investing in embryonic stem cell research? No. They're investing in adult stem cell research because that's where the research is really being successful. So even the market tells me where the money is, which means where the success rates are. So why do politicians and these scientists have to refer to referenda for government funding based on taxpayer money? To get money for their projects because VC firms won't invest in them. Doesn't that tell you everything? I mean, morality outside of it all, the market doesn't even respect embryonic stem cell research, so you have to tax people in order to get the money to do it. See how twisted that is? Okay, and that's what happens. Okay, so the answer would be no, and I'm just drawing this backward from an easy example of benefiting from other people's sin. You can't keep the $300 in the same way that you can't use fetal tissue from an aborted fetus to benefit someone else because you're creating a demand, or a need for that kind of work to be done. I mean, the best way to strangle out one of the best ways to strangle out that kind of work is to have no demand for it. That's the best way to do it. You know, and that's what the market respects. You know, so even if you're coming in from a business ethics point of view, it kind of also holds water in that regard. Okay? So, all right. Other questions? Yes. Two-fold question. This is going to be good. I know. I just have a good sense of this.
When there's a capital punishment.
Grave matter? Does capital punishment constitute grave matter? Okay. Sure.
Punishment.
Yeah. So, I'm sorry. Does the use of capital punishment always mean grave matter? Okay. Sure. Okay, right. Well, let me answer the question first, and then if I'm missing the pieces, then let me know. Okay. We'll get into this in the Fifth Commandment discussion. We'll talk about just war and capital punishment. Okay. A lot of people try to equate abortion and capital punishment. They're both life issues, right? And if you're against abortion, you should be against capital punishment. Okay. Yes, you should. But there's a difference between abortion and capital punishment. Abortion, including cases of rape and incest, is never justifiable. It's intrinsically evil. The taking of an innocent human life in the womb is always intrinsically evil. There's never a good reason that could justify it. Okay? However, the use of capital punishment is not intrinsically evil, according to the Catechism. And there are circumstances where it can and maybe should be used. For example, if you cannot incarcerate that said prisoner without him being a threat to the outside. I'll give you an example. Some years ago, maybe 4 years ago, Governor Schwarzenegger, the Terminator, in California, was asked to grant clemency to a Crip named Tukey. Remember this case, some of you? Tukey was championed by Hollywood elites as being this reformed leader of the Crips in East L.A. They say that Tukey had shown his remorse for what he had done because he was now making children's books. Interestingly, 4 weeks before Tukey's capital offense trial, there was a hit on the three star witnesses of the state. Which Tukey, we find out later, orchestrated in code language when receiving visitation from his fellow Crips. Tukey was incarcerated, but remained a threat to the outside because he was ordering hits on star witnesses who could testify for his guilt. Clemency was not granted, and Tukey was lethally injected. Is that a just use of capital punishment? You bet. Because Tukey continued to be a menace even though he was incarcerated. You see? Capital punishment in that case is not a bad... I mean, it's always grave matter because you're taking a life. So to answer your question, taking a life is always grave matter. But is there a sin of the society there? No. Because your intent is not to take Tukey's life as it is to protect the common good that is the citizenry on the outside. See that? Okay. Now, does that answer all your questions or not yet? Okay, same question. Okay, so I'm getting close. I can feel it. Okay.
The second one is the, which is exposed to the benefits of sin.
Who benefits from sin?
Yeah,
well, it could be all kinds of people.
If somebody is using you as an accessory, if you're not aware of it.
If you're not aware of being an accessory to a sin, are you a culpable? No. Unless you should be. Aware. Like, for example, let's say going to Mass. Right? Let's say your 13-year-old daughter is somehow manipulating the use of the car that you're giving permission for her use so that she doesn't have to go to Mass. Right? Okay. Now, should you know that? That she's doing that? Well, you should know that, I guess. But man, 13-year-olds are devious. And so maybe she's really got you wool over your eyes. Okay? So maybe I'm putting up a straw man there. But the idea here is that if you are an accessory to a crime and you know it, or you should know it, you can be culpable for that. If you don't know it, and really there's no reasonable way for you to know it, then no. Okay. Yeah. All right. That good? Okay. Any questions about that? Okay. Can I close? Okay. Where's Francis? She's not here. Okay. All right. In the name of the Father, and the Son, and the Holy Spirit, amen. Glory be to the Father, and to the Son, and to the Holy Spirit, as it was in the beginning, is now, and ever shall be, world without end, amen. In the name of the Father, and the Son, and the Holy Spirit, amen. Okay, before you go, two things. Please remember to sign in if you need to be here. The sign-in sheet's right here. And the second thing is that if you want to volunteer to bring something for this reception of December 13, an hors d'oeuvre or an appetizer, something, Joan Niebel has these little cards up here, and you can take one, contact her, and she'll give you the details. Thanks for playing. See you next week.